This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hello again. Welcome to the Doctor's Lounge, where you get to hear the private conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Karuchak. Everybody calls me Dr. K, and I strongly suggest you do the same, because if you try to pronounce that last name, you might get hurt. But don't say I didn't warn you. My goal on this show is to push both doctors and health information technology folks out of their comfort zone to try to solve some of these problems that we're having between the healthcare system and health information technology. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, a 501c3 organization dedicated to patient choice in healthcare. At the Doctor's Lounge, we would love to hear from you. Please email us at doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. One more time, that's doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. Well, I'm delighted to be back from vacation, and is usually the case with Karuchak family vacations, it's good to be back at work so I can get a little rest. So today, we're going to look at the question of your medical privacy in the medical information technology age. And the talk couldn't be more timely in the wake of one of yesterday's big news headlines, in which a group of Russian hackers, I don't know if this organized crime was referred to in different ways, but somebody on the other side of the Atlantic gained access to worldwide 1.3 billion, that's not million, that's 1.3 billion user password name combinations. And there was nothing I could find to figure out where they got them or how they got them. But, of course, they've accessed a huge number of these. This is four user password combinations for every man, woman, and child in the United States. So this is a huge data breach. And so it certainly raises the question, especially when you realize that most people, you and I, use the same username and passwords for multiple things that we log into. So if they get one of our username password combinations, they can probably get into most, if not all, of the places that we presume to log into privately. And so it raises the question, is your medical information safe? Right? Your medical information is stored electronically all over the place. Even if your doctor doesn't have an EMR, they have to be submitting their claims electronically. And so, you know, it almost sidesteps the question of EMR, and we'll look at some data to address that question down the road here in the hour. In 2 minutes, I'm going to tell you the seven things that you need to know about your medical privacy. But first, I'm going to digress and give you one story, which I try to do at the top of every show. We're going to borrow a little device from late-night TV. You know, if you're old enough and you watch late-night TV in decades gone by, they used to have things called stupid pet tricks or stupid human tricks. And we're going to go into stupid health information technology tricks. So here's the story. If you're a physician, you understand that, getting a patient a prescription, getting a medication into the hands of a patient, is not as easy as it used to be. In the old days, you'd write a paper prescription, they'd take it to the pharmacy, medicine would get filled, you know, almost no questions asked, unless, of course, they couldn't read your handwriting. But that's not the case anymore. More often than not, you're going to get a note back from the pharmacy for many medications that request something called a prior authorization. And I never understood the concept of a prior authorization. I mean, I thought my prescription was an authorization, but I guess they have to send me another piece of paper that says, well, I guess we just want to make sure you really wanted that patient to have that medication. Maybe you were kidding when you wrote the prescription. But no, that's not really true. You don't really have to ask me the same question twice. I wasn't really kidding the first time. If I write a prescription, that's my authorization. I don't need to do another authorization. Well, this story is about something that was even worse, and doctors are familiar with this too, and that is when you get a note back from the pharmacy and it's not a prior authorization request, it's a formulary substitution request. And that's even worse than the prior authorization request. That basically says, doctor, we're not even going to fill that prescription. Don't even ask, because it's not on the formulary. So, you know, either the patient pays for it out of their own pocket or this prescription is just not going to happen. So the other day I got a formulary substitution request, and it was for an allergy medication that is fairly new and is fairly expensive, but it's actually a substitute for two other medicines. And they said, well, we're not going to give this prescription. Please consider one of the following five options, and they gave me five options on this piece of paper faxed to my office to pick from. And I looked at the five options, and I said, well, this is rather curious. I don't recognize any of these other five medications. And, you know, we treat allergy in ear, nose, and throat practice. We're pretty good at it. We do it all the time. And we're familiar with the medications, all of the choices that you have to treat allergies. And I'm looking at this list, and I'm not seeing any drugs I recognize, to the point where I had to look them up. And it turns out that none of those drugs were allergy medications. In fact, most of the drugs were blood pressure medications, and one of the drugs was a drug for an enlarged prostate gland. So that's a rather scary computer-generated mistake. So if you understand programming, you understand that that's probably an error in a single line of programming code. Obviously, no human being generated this document that was sent to me. And probably the drug that I wanted to prescribe was misclassified in their database as a blood pressure medicine or a prostate medicine, and so the substitutions came out of the same category. But that's an awful mistake. Oh, yeah, what if that piece of paper hadn't landed in my hands? What if it had landed in the hands of, you know, a well-meaning staffer who wanted to spare me the trouble and just circled one of the choices and faxed it back? I would have had my name on a prescription for blood pressure medication put in the hands of a patient who has allergies. So the IT people go, well, hey, that's no problem, no big deal. We'll just fix that line of programming. And you know, in the IT world, they see that totally differently. Well, it's just a mistake. All programs have bugs. We just fix it. No big deal. But the physician sees that completely differently for obvious reasons because, you know, how many people got that piece of paper and how many people were inappropriately prescribed a blood pressure medicine for allergies? I mean, literally, you could kill somebody doing that kind of thing. So, again, you know, the point here is, as we discussed last time, you can hurt a patient, you can do harm to a patient just as easily with a misguided computer system as you can with a misguided scalpel or a misguided prescription. And in this particular example, we had a misguided computer system that was trying to generate a misguided prescription. But there is this belief in the health IT community that computers are benign and computers can't really hurt people. And, you know, we're going to try to come up with stories every show to sort of illustrate this point. But clearly, you know, the potential for computers to do harm is dreadfully misunderstood and dreadfully underestimated. So as I promised, after the story, here's the things, the seven things that you need to know. This kind of summarizes the rest of the show. But here are the seven things that you need to know about medical privacy. Item number one, medical privacy is relevant. These laws, you know, I don't like the way they're executed. We're going to talk about, you know, why I think they're not very good. But some sort of protection needs to be in place for two reasons. The first is, as doctors all know, you know, we took a Hippocratic Oath. We're going to talk about the Hippocratic Oath later on. That we pledged not only to do no harm to patients, we also pledged to hold our patients' secrets as sacred and not to disclose those. So when a patient comes in to see us, they trust that when they have to trust certain pieces of medical information to us and certain facts about their past and their lifestyle to us, that we're going to keep those secret. And the second obligation regarding privacy is something that's an unfortunate consequence of the information age and is, you know, directly relevant to yesterday's headline about hackers stealing usernames and passwords, is that medical data, especially the demographic data, can be used for identity theft. And so certainly medical privacy is relevant. Medical privacy is absolutely positively needed. And it's just a matter of getting it right, which, in my opinion, hasn't happened yet. Item number two in the seven things that you need to know about medical privacy is that when your medical information is digitized, when it's put online, whether that's in an electronic claim system or an electronic medical record, that you are going to compromise the ability to protect that record. A paper record has a physical barrier. It enjoys a physical barrier. I can take that paper record, I can put it in a closet, I can lock it up, and there's no way that Russian hackers from 5,000 miles away can easily get to it. And that's just something that we have to work around. There's no way around it. Item number three of the seven things that you need to know, and we're going to talk about this in detail later on as well, is that as a culture, we are surrendering our privacy to the digital age. And so everything that we're trying to do to protect patients' medical privacy flies in the face of everything that our culture is doing with social media and smartphones and smart cars and smart everything else, we are in general surrendering our privacy to huge databases, to digital cameras, to all of these different things. And so privacy laws are definitely needed. The next item in our list of seven is that our current privacy laws don't do this well. These laws are vague, these laws are ineffective, and these laws cripple very practical ways for us to communicate with patients and with each other, mainly in the form of text and email. Now, text and email have their technology issues, they have their privacy issues, but at the moment, the vague wording of the HIPAA regulations makes this a very difficult problem. As a result, item number six of our list of seven is that complete compliance, and this is true just with just about any set of medical regulations. We have tens of thousands, arguably hundreds of thousands of regulations that apply to the behavior of a medical practice, and to get every single one of those pages right, of the hundreds of thousands of pages, even with outside consulting help, is darn near impossible. There's going to be, even with the purest of intentions, even with the most devoted attitude of being fully compliant with the law, that there's got to be somewhere on one of those tens of thousands of pages that you're doing something wrong. And then we come to the last of the seven, which is one of the ones that irritates me the most, is that the health information technology community, not everyone, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but there are many folks in the health IT community that are using all of these regulations to promote fear and to leverage that fear to sell us products that are absolutely useless. Right? All they're doing is taking our money. So let me go back. Now, again, the spirit of HIPAA, right, the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, right, passed by the Clinton administration in 1996, I think, was a good idea at the time. And this may be the only time I ever say that about a government law, but at the time it was a good idea because culturally, back at that time, we did not recognize the huge multiplier that digitalizing records took. The fact that once you put somebody's patient information online, the ability of that to be replicated and duplicated around the world is something that we did not understand at the time. So the fact that those laws were created in the first place is not a bad thing. The problem is since that time, the laws have been updated, the implementation has been changed, and as a result, we now have a health privacy regulatory structure that is very complex, extremely difficult to understand. And it was a case of thinking that if a little bit is good, that more must be better, and that simply is not the case. We are coming up on the first break. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that wellness and prevention is the key to living a long and healthy life? For example, common diseases such as acid reflux, high cholesterol, non-insulin-dependent diabetes, and high blood pressure, in some cases, are caused by poor nutrition. Scientific studies suggest the use of nutritional supplements, a healthy diet, and exercise can control and, in some cases, prevent disease. Use nutritional supplements that are formulated using good manufacturer practice standards, and remember to let your doctor know what you are taking, since it can react with prescription medication. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to the Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, It seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Karuchak, and I'm very happy that you've decided to spend a little bit of your time with me today. We're in the second segment of the program, and in the first segment, we talked a little bit about health information technology and the privacy issues. We're going to talk about that some more. We also talked about some examples of how information technology, when not perfectly designed and perfectly implemented, can indeed hurt patients. And we're going to take that idea down the road a little bit farther. And as we talked about in the last segment, you can hurt a patient with a computer. You can do harm to a patient with information technology just as easily as you can with a scalpel or with a prescription pad if you don't know what you're doing. And as a group, the combination of medicine and health information technology, we don't know what we're doing with that combination of force. And the fund of knowledge required to safely and effectively use health information technology is not developed enough to support the explosive growth in health information technology that has been forced upon us over the past 5 years by the Meaningful Use Incentive Program, other government incentives and penalty programs. And as a result, patients are at risk. Right now, today, patients are at risk of being hurt by health information technology because we don't have the experience, we don't have the fund of knowledge to support the explosive growth that has been forced upon us by the government. No one is denying that as you implement this stuff, there are going to be mistakes, there are going to be issues. That part's unavoidable. The part that could have been avoided was the huge multiplier. Why not make these mistakes in pilot programs? Why not make these mistakes on a small scale before we force this thing to go large scale? And now we have, you know, over 500,000 providers on electronic medical records thanks to the Meaningful Use program. Now, a programming mistake that would only affect one system is affecting hundreds of systems, thousands of providers, hundreds of thousands of patients. And that is really, really a bad thing. If you don't believe me, here's some examples. It turns out that the FDA has what they call an adverse event database. And I think this is a place, and I didn't know about this until I researched this for the program, that if you have an issue with a health information technology system with an EMR, that you can report that. So let's look at a couple of the examples that are on this this database and examine how health information technology people would look at this versus how providers look at this. So here's the first example. Now, a patient with a documented allergy to penicillin received the drug ampicillin, which is a penicillin class drug. If you're allergic to penicillin, you're allergic to ampicillin. So this patient who's allergic to penicillin received ampicillin and went into anaphylactic shock. And the question was, well, how did they get the ampicillin? The penicillin allergy was recorded. How did this fall through the cracks, especially in an electronic medical system database? Well, it turned out, and I'm inferring here a little bit. The description online is short, so I'm inferring a little bit. I'll say that up front, that they had a hybrid system going. They were midway through their implementation. They had some orders on paper, and they had some orders in an electronic system. And the penicillin allergy was recorded on paper, but not in the electronic system. So when the ampicillin was ordered, that was probably electronic. It went through. There was no documentation of the penicillin allergy in the electronic system, and the ampicillin ends up being given to the patient, and they go instantly into a life-threatening condition. The provider's reaction to this is obvious. This is obviously a terrible thing. Something really, really bad went wrong. A patient was hurt, and there's no question that the health provider regards this as catastrophic. The health information technology person is going to say the same thing. Yeah, that's a bad thing, but you know what? It's not my product's fault, right? This is if the person who sold this system to the hospital is going to say, well, hey, you know, if you didn't enter it in the database, you know, how can I be responsible? And the point is that the definition of responsibility in this setting is broader to the physician than it is to the health IT person, because the health IT person doesn't see beyond their product. And if their product's working, right, you plugged it in, you turned it on, all the screens came up, the network was connected. And if all that stuff sort of works, then in their mind, their liability ends. And I think I have some license to say this because I've been working in health information technology for about 40 years. Since the 70s, I have been in health information technology off and on. So, you know, I've spent a long time in this environment, so I don't think I'm overstepping my bounds to suggest that I know how an information technology person is going to think about something like this. The definition of responsibility has to be broadened to understand that the interaction between humans and the paper and the machines is what needs to be studied and what needs to be well understood. And now, you know, we have a situation where, you know, this technology is everywhere and we have things going on that we don't understand. Example number two. There's a drug called potassium chloride. It's given to folks whose potassium level is low, and it's given, you know, fairly regularly, especially when people are on certain drugs called diuretics or water pills. A lot of those pills will cause your potassium level to be low, and so you supplement that with potassium chloride. Very commonly done. The kicker is, if you're going to do that, you need to monitor the patient's potassium level very closely, because if you over-supplement, the potassium level is going to go too high. And if the potassium level goes too high, the heart can stop right there. That's what happened to my dad when he was in the hospital, and that's a long story. It wasn't anybody's fault, but it was hyperkalemia that brought about his end the day that it happened. And the system that was set up was reporting labs. In this particular incident, they had an electronic record in this hospital. The labs were being reported, but there was no alert given because of the high potassium. The number was there, but there was no red flag, there was no warning, there was none of that stuff. And so the patient was given potassium, even though their level was already high, they had been supplemented adequately, now they were given more. And although the patient didn't die, the report in the database says that other patients had died. So, you know, here's a situation where, you know, the alert stuff wasn't set up right. Again, the IT person is going to say, well, the alert was there. The system wasn't configured correctly. The physician's going to say something different. What I would say to that is that, you know, we've become too dependent on the alerts, right? And health information technology folks, the folks who promote this stuff, are going to tell you, oh, yeah, you know, this is good stuff. We can, you know, we're going to do what they call clinical decision support. That means, you know, when a certain constellation of facts comes to light about a certain patient, they're going to give you a big flashing flag on the screen and say, you need to do something, you know, because we have this, you know, constellation of data in the system that suggests that a certain medical step is necessary. And that's fine in concept, but a couple of things happen. The biggest one is called alert fatigue. And that is that if you're constantly getting beeped at, flashed at, you know, yelled at by a computer, that eventually you're going to ignore it. Or you're going to become dependent on it and assume that anything you're doing is okay as long as the computer is not warning you to the contrary. And my guess, and again, I'm inferring a lot here, admit that up front, but my guess is that in this system they became so dependent on the alerts that if they do something to a patient and there's no alert, well, everything must be okay. So it sort of usurps the ability of the provider to think for themselves, you know, if the stars line up just right, because we're supposed to become dependent on these alerts instead of thinking for ourselves. So if you look at all of these examples, you just realize we're going too fast. And instead of making mistakes on a small scale, we're making mistakes on a huge scale. And that's not good. Not good. Okay, so we're done with examples for today. We'll have more next time, I promise. We're going to look now at the history of medical privacy, and we're going to start with a little news flash for those of you who are big government lovers, big government supporters, and think that people can't do anything without the big helping hand of government. Well, here's a little surprise for you, that the government did not invent medical privacy in 1986 when they passed HIPAA, 1996. When they passed HIPAA, guess what? Medical providers came up with privacy about 2,500 years ago when the Hippocratic Oath was created. And everyone says, hey, I know the Hippocratic Oath. That's where we say we do no harm. Well, that's true. Yes, when we all graduate from medical school, we're given the opportunity. It's not mandatory anymore. We're given the opportunity to take the Hippocratic Oath, which says, yes, we will do no harm. But it actually has seven pledges. And the last of those pledges has to do with medical privacy. Now, there's a lot of different translations and a lot of different versions of the oath, but I'm going to read you verbatim from one that I found that seems to be the clearest. Quote, "Whatever I see or hear in the lives of my patients, whether in connection with my professional practice or not, which ought not to be spoken of outside, I will keep secret, as considering all such things to be private." So if you read this carefully, the original intent of the Hippocratic Oath was that the physician could exercise judgment. Not everything absolutely positively had to be kept private, no matter what the condition. You would have an option under the Hippocratic Oath, for example, that if a patient came into you and they had a drug problem or an alcohol problem or something like that, that the doctor did have the prerogative under the Hippocratic Oath to mobilize the patient's family, to mobilize the patient's support system, call the patient's friends, parents, whatever, and say, look, we have a patient here with a problem. We're going to need your help and your support to get them out of this problem. That is not something that would be allowable today. Since the Hippocratic Oath was created about 2,500 years ago, if you read review articles, you'll find that, you know, through the ages, through the Roman Empire, through the Middle Ages, through, you know, the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, that medical writings consistently will refer back to the Hippocratic Oath and emphasize the need for patient privacy. With one kind of interesting exception, and this was interesting, in a code of medical ethics written about that time, they suggested that a patient that has a terminal condition, that you don't tell the patient that their condition is terminal, that they're going to die and that they're not going to survive, but you do tell the family and you do tell the friends. So you have the situation where the patient is living in ignorant bliss, but everyone else around them knows the gravity of what's going on. You know, that didn't last. And by the beginning of the 20th century, that was pretty much gone. But since the Hippocratic Oath has been was written, two things have changed. First is that privacy is no longer driven by the professionalism and the ethics of the physician. Privacy has been is now driven because it is a right of patients, and that is fine in most cases, although it does deprive the physician of any ability to exercise clinical judgment in terms of mobilizing a patient's support network to help them treat their problem. The other thing that has changed is that the Hippocratic Oath did not contemplate medical records. The Hippocratic Oath really only prescribes how the physician himself behaves in terms of what he says and where he goes, but doesn't say anything about how to manage records. And obviously, the records thing has been a big deal. You know, I was born in the early 1960s, and if you look at my medical record from my pediatrician, which I have at home, my entire 18 years of life fits in a 5x7 manila folder with about 10 sheets of paper in it, with one-line entries. If I came in for a checkup, it says checkup. That's it, one word. You know, why is that? Because the only purpose of medical records at the time in the 60s was the physician's personal notes. And half the time, he'd remember who you were anyway. So it was merely just a way, a memory jog is really all that was. There was no need to document to an insurance company the care was delivered. There was no need for defensive medicine to keep the malpractice attorneys away. There was no pay for performance. There was no managed care. There was none of those things. And if you strip out the need for all of those things, then all you have is a physician's personal notes, then you don't really need much more than a few 5x7 note cards to summarize 18 years. Assuming you're blessed with good health, which is I was. And again, the security and privacy of that record, it's easy. You just lock it away. And between visits, there might be, you know, no one's going to touch that record. Since that time, a lot of things have happened. We have third-party payer systems, malpractice liability, managed care, compliance audits. And so two things happen to your medical records. One is they have to have a whole lot more in them. And the second is that the audience is much broader and the access has to be much more open. We are at the end of the second segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
This is Michael Gannot with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you Insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Solution providers, are you aware of the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism's multiple marketing platforms? You're invited to get a little closer to IHC with our Solution Provider Membership Marketing Program. Through IHC's exclusive Solution Provider Membership, your business gets an all-access pass to engaging your prospects. This membership embeds your business within the Institute, which immediately aligns your company, its solutions, and your key executives with the nationally credible IHC brand and shows your support of the healthcare consumerism movement as a market-wide solution. And that's just the beginning. Contact IHC's Managing Director, Brent Macy, today at bmacy@theihcc.com.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, your host, and I am delighted that you've decided to spend a little time with me this morning. In the third segment of the program, we're going to talk about the huge cultural difference between what federal regulators are trying to do to maintain medical privacy and the huge cultural shift that we are undergoing as a culture as a whole, not just medically, but our entire culture, in which we are surrendering our privacy. So we're trying to push this in a completely opposite direction. I mean, obviously, medical privacy is an important thing. It's a legitimate thing. It's something that we want to do, but it flies in the face of what especially our younger folks, and I talked to my kids about it, and I'll tell you what they had to say in a minute, that they just don't care. They are very happy to surrender their privacy, and it's just not an issue to them the way it's an issue to lots of other folks. And it's very difficult to fight for privacy when the rest of society is completely going the other way. So when I was researching this segment, I started with a conversation with my kids, my daughter Margaret and my son Andrew, to see, you know, how they feel about all this social media and how they feel about it impacting their privacy. And basically, they don't mind. The only thing, you know, where they draw the line, and I asked, I said, well, where would you draw the line on something that was posted on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, the stuff that they use, which is more like Instagram and Snapchat and Vine, probably stuff if you're over 50 like me, you wouldn't even know about it if it wasn't for your children. You know, where do you draw the line? Well, they're pretty clear that if it's something that is, you know, sexually explicit or something like that, that's been drilled into them by us and at their school and everything else. So thankfully, that's the first thing that they say, and that they understand that there's a huge, you know, line in the sand there that absolutely nobody should ever cross. But short of that, there's really nothing else that bothers them about having all of this social media and smartphones and all that kind of stuff invade their privacy. And there was actually one time when my daughter and I were driving in the car and we were being silly and cutting up and singing to the radio and all that kind of stuff. And I look over and all of a sudden, my daughter's, you know, taking a video of me, you know, singing in the car and posted on Snapchat or Vine. I'm not even sure which of these they are. Even at my level, I don't really understand the difference between some of these. And it kind of upset me a little bit. And it was one of those times when you have to have one of those parenting teaching moments and say, look, you do not post pictures, videos, anything else of some other person without their knowledge and without their consent. But they do it to each other all the time. And in the culture of my children, none of that is, you know, any kind of big deal. So we have a variety of social media that we surrender our privacy to. Those things want to tie into the GPS function on our cell phones and transmit our location on an ongoing 24/7 basis. In health apps, right, there are, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but, you know, there's a big push called mobile health or mHealth, little m, big H, mHealth. You know, like everything else, it has to start with a lowercase letter and then have a capital letter second, like iPad or iPhone. This is mHealth. And, you know, their big push is to use the power of the smartphone to improve medical care. Well, that's a good concept. I like the idea. They have a lot of good ideas. I've been to a couple of their meetings and I follow their literature, and it's, you know, there's a lot of good stuff there. But again, it's a privacy issue. And now, you know, you might have very intimate details about your bodily functions, conceivably, once the technology becomes available, and this is going to go online and be accessible to whoever wants to log into it, hack into it, whatever. So we have cell phones that can track our location 24/7, and, you know, at some point we crossed a cultural boundary where we never turn our cell phones off. And it wasn't always that way. And I can remember when I got my first cell phone. There's a small story here that I think is worthy of telling. I got my first cell phone when I was a resident, probably a third, fourth year resident in my second or third or first or second year of the ear, nose, and throat part of my residency training. And at the time, nobody had cell phones. And so we had pagers, we had beepers. And so we had to be available for our attendings, for our professors, to do what they wanted to be done. That's how it works. No problem. But we always had a desire, because you get tired of hospital food after a while, we always had a desire to leave the hospital and go somewhere nearby to have a decent lunch. It's one of the few pleasures in residency you get when you're not sleeping and you're eating hospital food all the time. If you can get out and get a little sushi or get a little something else, that's kind of nice. The problem was is that the attendings appropriately, you know, our attendings made it clear, no, you're not supposed to leave the hospital because we've got patients here, you need to stay, we're going to need you to do stuff, and, you know, we need you available on a moment's notice. We don't even want you one or two blocks away. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, as it was in the adolescence of my medical career, we were looking for ways to be less traceable. And ironically, the cell phone at that point, because it was nothing but a big brick with a dial pad on it, that the cell phone made us less traceable, because it was the need to be near a landline when you were paged that was the problem. And so when the cell phone came along, I thought, well, this is cool. I can go a block or two down the road and go eat at a restaurant with some buddies. And if we get a page, we have a phone. And we can just answer it. And the person on the other end doesn't know the difference if they paid you and you answer right away. Their assumption is you're in the hospital, because where else is their phone? And so it was a way to kind of be untraceable. Unfortunately, and I should have realized this ahead of time, that my professors were a whole lot smarter than I am, and they figured out what was going on. And although they didn't let on until one day I was walking down the sidewalk and I was talking to one of my professors, thinking I was putting one over on him. And then he said, "Is that traffic noise I hear in the background?" So he figured it out eventually. But again, a technological irony here, where when cell phones were primitive, they made you less traceable. As cell phones advanced, the effect completely flip-flopped. And now with modern cell phones, you are completely traceable. You know, in this country, there are 327 million cell phones, by one online estimate I looked up, which is about the population of the country, which by some is listed as about 313 million. So there's about as many cell phones as there are heartbeats in this nation. And every single one of those cell phones is connected to the internet, and every single one of those cell phones has a camera on it, and every single one of those cell phones is can spy on you, whether it's your own phone, obviously, or somebody else's. And it's going to get even better. Now we have Google Glass. Right? I have a friend from the Twitter sphere. He knows who he is. I hope he's listening. That wears a Google Glass all the time. Well, there's another way to keep a camera pointed at everyone all the time. And if you combine that with the technology that's available with face recognition and photo content recognition, it now becomes conceivable that just about everybody on the planet can be tracked in real time, second to second. If that's not enough, we got more, right? We got your credit card, right? Every time you swipe your credit card, you're pinging the bank and you're pinging the grid with how much you're spending, what you're buying, and where you are. At home, no better. Your web provider, your internet provider at home, your cell internet provider knows every page that you visit all the time. Every search that you do is logged by Google. Every time you go to the grocery store and use your little preferred customer card, they are assembling a profile on the stuff you buy. And if you accumulate that data over 6 months, 12 months, a couple of years, they get a huge amount of detail in terms of who you are. Even your car is connected, right? If you have a car that is modern enough that it's a push-button start switch instead of sticking the key in the ignition and giving it a twist, odds are that car has the capability to communicate with the manufacturer and broadcast the car's location, how many miles are on it. You know, have you ever wondered why it seems appropriately timed that you get a letter from your car dealer every time you need an oil change? Well, that's no accident. That's because when you hit 6,000 miles or 5,000 or whatever the dealer recommends between the changes, the car sends a signal to the dealer and says it's time for an oil change, and you get a piece of mail. So all this stuff happens in the background. And if that's not enough, right, we know about the government. We know about the NSA, and we know that they have been wholesale spying on American citizens, whether there was reason to or not. And again, some of this stuff's good, right? I mean, I like the idea of the car that's connected. I mean, there's good stuff there. I mean, if you get in an accident, right, your car runs off the road, you hit a tree, you hit your head, you get knocked out, you can't call for help, the car has accident sensors in it, and it will automatically send an SOS call, so the ambulance and the police and the fire are on their way, and you don't have to do anything. So, you know, all this technology has two sides. In the situation of the car example, it can save your life. In other situations, it can grossly intrude on your privacy and you have no idea what's going on. And then, you know, as we approach the end of the segment here, the last thing that is probably the scariest is that all of these databases are getting combined, or they're looking at getting those combined. And so that has, you know, sort of an impact on healthcare because, let's say I see you as a patient and I say, we need to put you on a reflux diet. That means you can't have tobacco, you can't have alcohol, you have to minimize your caffeine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I have that conversation with patients 10 times a day. After the show, I'll go back before noon. I will be talking to a patient about that for sure. But the technology is fast becoming available that as your doctor, I could monitor you, right? And if you leave my office and you go to Dunkin' Donuts and buy some coffee, then I would know about it. And you might say, well, hey, that's good. That means I can have somebody call you up and say, hey, you know, what are you doing with that coffee? I just told you no more caffeine. What are you getting that coffee for? You know, if you were lowering your cholesterol, what'd you buy 3 bags of chips for? Is that good or is that bad? Well, it might be good. You know, it might be, you know, some patients out there that'll go, well, yeah, I just needed a reminder in real time. I get it now. You know, I suppose that's good. But on the other hand, the privacy issue becomes a big deal. You know, I don't want my doctor, if I'm a patient, maybe I don't want my doctor knowing, what I'm doing. I have the right as an individual to follow medical advice I'm given or to not follow that advice. But, you know, all sorts of conflicts of interest can come up. What if I, as a physician, had been forced to enroll in a pay-for-performance program, and now I'm going to get paid based on how well, for example, my reflux patients do? So now I'm going to be hugely incentivized to spy on you so that if you go out and buy, you know, a 5-pound bag of Dunkin' Donuts coffee, that I'm going to be incentivized to call you up and hassle you over it because I'm in a pay-for-performance program that says if I let you go buy your cup of coffee or your alcohol or whatever, that it's going to cost me financially. So you end up with all sorts of, you know, perverse incentives and conflicts of interest going on. And this is impacting us in our daily practice today. This whole idea of the surrendering of medical privacy is having an impact on our daily practice. And where that happens the most is when we're talking about emailing and texting between us and patients. And we'll get into what the regulations say about that in the last segment. But it is common. It is common for prospective patients, right? We have a website. Patients go to that website. They see contact information there. They reach out to us and they want to give us information. They want to give us a picture of an x-ray or a picture of a sinus CT scan or a picture of their distorted nose and say, can you help me? And there are all sorts of regulatory issues with that. We'll finish that thought after the break. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Certification. Do you know why becoming a certified healthcare consumerism specialist is more important than ever in 2014? Adding this specialized designation to your credentials tells employers or your clients that you understand how much our industry has changed and how to navigate that change successfully. IHC University's certification program offers coursework both online and live at their biannual forum conference series, and testing is completed online. Reaffirm your position as a leader in the health and benefit management industry. Download our certification overview and learn more at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back to the Doctor's Lounge. You are listening to America's Web Radio, and I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. And again, thanks so much for spending some time with me today. Before we get into the theme of the fourth segment, I want to finish a thought that we were talking about in the third segment and had to go to the break, and that is that this surrendering of privacy by our society, our complicit permission to allow our cell phones and our cars and our digital cameras to intrude upon what we do and how we do it and when we do it and with whom we do it, that is having a direct impact on our medical practices today, right now. And this has to do with prospective patients who reach out to our practice either by finding us, you know, web search, our website, whatever. And folks understand that the technology is out there, that I don't have to go through a huge doctor visit. I can at least, you know, ping somebody that I might want to see as a patient and say, well, here's my x-ray. Here's a picture of my busted nose. Here's my primary doctor's office note. Can you take 2 seconds and look this over and tell me if you're the right doctor for me to see, or if not, you know, another doctor? And we don't have a problem doing that, except that they want to email that stuff to us. And we get them on the phone and they say, well, what's your email? We'll send this to you. And we say, well, you really can't send that to us. You know, you can, but, you know, we need a written statement from you or something that says that you understand that what you're sending is not secure, and you mentally have to, you know, understand that, you know, whatever you're sending us, you know, you have to be comfortable that would be broadcast on the evening news, for example, because we can't guarantee the privacy or that some prying eyes aren't going to look at what you're going to send. And some folks will respond to that fine. Others will just say, thank you, hang up, and, you know, that's lost. It's a patient that's going to go somewhere else. And ironically, the practice that doesn't pay attention to the law is going to say, yeah, great, email it to us, and they get the business and we don't. So this is becoming a problem. And you know, we also have issues with, you know, texting and emailing, you know, between, you know, providers in different practices. And we'll get into that a little bit. But there's no question that the government is forcing more privacy on us than patients want. And I don't know what the answer to that is. Some folks may say, well, they don't understand what the risks are, and it's our job to protect them from what they don't understand. Maybe so. But the bottom line is, we still don't have the infrastructure. We still don't have the technology. We don't have the experience or the fund of knowledge to fully understand the dilemma we face. And that's hurting us right now. So as we talk into the last segment here, I'm going to try to give you some intelligent things that you can do in your practice from a real basis, not so much from a regulatory basis, because that is just entirely too confusing, but in the real world, things that you can do to make your patient's data safer, and if you're a patient, not a doctor, even a patient, things that you can do to keep your data safer, or things that you can do to help your doctor. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about HIPAA compliance because that is too complicated. Regulatory compliance is too complicated. Remember, HIPAA was created in 1996, and as I've said a couple of times already, that HIPAA is a good thing in its original conception, because culturally we had no idea what we were getting into when we started putting stuff online, you know, back in the 90s when it wasn't so much EMR as it was electronic claims data. The trouble is it's been amended several times, right? When the stimulus bill came along and high-tech and meaningful use came along, there was also a little Trojan horse in there that raised the bar for privacy. And then in 2013, the bar was raised again with something called the HIPAA Omnibus Bill. And then in 2014... the government totally changed the game by saying, well, instead of us waiting until you actually have a breach to investigate you, now they can do audits. So just like they can do with coding compliance, just like they can do with other issues, they can just pull your name out of a hat, even though you haven't done anything wrong. And so you might say, well, gosh, I really want to do this, right? As we have done, we have the fullest intent to being totally compliant with the law. And you think, okay, I'm going to do this. So what do you start with? Well, you start with, you know, the government websites, right? CMS.gov, HealthIT.gov. And if you go to the website HealthIT.gov, it looks good at first. They say, we have a security risk assessment tool. You can download this. You can apply it to your practice. We have a tool. Use it. That's great, except for one thing. There's a disclaimer on the government website. This is supposed to be the primary source of where you go for what is it that you need to do to comply with the law. So here's the, but there's a disclaimer. The security, and I'm quoting here. I pasted this off the website. Here's the quote. The security risk assessment tool at healthit.gov is provided for informational purposes only. Use of this tool is neither required or it does not guarantee compliance with federal, state, and local laws. Please note the information not be appropriate for all providers and all organizations. So you go to the primary source, and the primary source has a disclaimer that says, well, you know what, this isn't enough. So, you know, the government's, the primary source is disclaiming their own information. So you can't even go to the government and get a straight answer on what you need to do. You know, even if you're willing to spend dozens of hours studying the original documents, the disclaimer is even if you're looking at the original documents or you're looking at a tool that the government created to help you, it doesn't help. So you say, well, okay, you know, we're going to get a consultant, right? That's what we tried. We've had, you know, IT consultants try to help us out. About a year ago, we decided we really needed to you know, up the ante, just like, you know, you look at your stuff every year. You're supposed to look at your practice every year and upgrade your privacy and security. You know, we have done the best job of that if we possibly can. And last year we said, okay, we're going to upgrade and get a fancy, you know, big time health IT company to help us with our network structure, privacy, security, all that stuff. And it turns out, and we chose one of the big names in town. Well, it turns out they didn't know squat. And we asked them basic questions. Is our email secure? What do we need to do to make our email secure if it isn't? How do we make our network secure? All of this basic stuff. And all they could say was, well, we're not sure. We'll get back to you. We'll research that and get back to you. Well, did they ever get back to us with answers? No, they didn't. As a result, we're switching providers as of September 1st. But the point is, you can't just outsource this the way you ought to be able to. You ought to be able to say, look, I'm going to pay a consultant a bunch of money. I want you to look at our practice from top to bottom and make everything right. Well, it turns out that even the big name consultants in town, right, in the Atlanta market, there are four of them. We used one of them. That failed. We interviewed the other three. Out of those three, the other two were totally clueless, and we're left with the fourth one, and we have very high hopes for them. But the point is that even the people who say that they know what they're doing don't know what they're doing. And again, it's not all their fault. I'm not saying this on the radio to bash the company that we used or the other ones that we interviewed. What I'm trying to say is nobody knows because we went too fast. The fund of knowledge just isn't out there. It took us months to figure out if our email was even secure and then take measures to do what we needed to do. And, you know, the technology's not there. You know, we have clueless government bureaucrats who think that they can fix a problem by passing a law. You know, the problem is the technology's not well developed enough to be both effective and practical to allow full compliance with what they're asking for. You know, it's like passing a law to make rainy weekends illegal. I mean, you can pass the law, but if you don't have a way to do it, what good's the law? And we almost have the same problem here. So let's try and come up with some intelligent advice. Again, here what I'm asking you to do is, you know, look at that other part of medical privacy. Look at the Hippocratic Oath and say, look, as a doc, you have a responsibility to keep your patient's data as private as you can. As a patient, you have an obligation to recognize the problem, recognize the risks, and work together with your doctor to keep your data as secure as present technology will allow. So to research this piece of it, I decided to go back to the government website. They do have one part there that is kind of useful, which is they have a place you can go to look at the breaches that have been reported. Right? The latest version of the law requires that if you have a data breach that involves more than 500 patients, that you have to report that. Now, you may get sanctions, fines, investigated, whatever, but you are obligated to report that. And you can go to a database and see all the stuff that's been reported for any time interval you want to look at. So I wanted stuff that was pretty up to date. So I ran a search that went from January 1st, 2014 to the end of June just to see what you find. What kind of, you know, what is the problem? How bad is the problem? And this is about the best primary data that you can go to. 2014, roughly year to date, probably first 6 months, there were 75 breaches reported. So among, you know, a million providers and, you know, hundreds of millions of patients, there were 75 breaches greater than 500 patients reported. And you can break those down and look at them as to what was the nature of the breach. And this is the really important stuff. This might be where, you know, if I were a university professor, I would say, if you don't remember anything else from this lecture, this is what you need to remember. So here's the one thing you need to remember is that the vast majority of the data breaches that were reported had nothing to do with an EMR, had nothing to do with hacking, had nothing to do with an ineffective network structure. It was the loss or theft of physical media. I'm talking your tablet, your laptop, your smartphone. And, you know, how many of us are guilty of carrying stuff on our laptop or on our tablets that is patient data? You take a picture of an x-ray, you want to keep that and take it to the operating room with you. You want to, you know, you're doing a research project and you have an Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of, you know, patient information in it. Or, you know, in 2012, Emory University was in the news because they lost about 22 computer disks that had surgical records from 315,000 patients. And it was this a classic thing. This was an old abandoned computer system. Nobody was using it anymore, and so they lost the disks. But again, the biggest risk is the loss of physical media. So if there's one thing you can do for your patients, do what our practice did and make a policy that no patient data goes on your local hard drive, on your laptop, or your tablet. All of our administrators work on what's called a virtual computer. Their laptop's only a terminal. Everything that they do to monitor the financial health of our practice and all that other stuff that happens in the background lives in the secure server. So if their laptop is lost or stolen, there's no data on that hard drive. There's nothing that a hacker can find. You know, I don't know if the regulations support that or not, or require it or not, but you need it. We'll finish all this next time. Thanks much for listening. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.